We're ready? Okay, I just want to say by way of a prologue how much fun I had doing the research for writing about and talking about Judge John Noonan. It surprised me what an interesting, unusual life he had, and it was a great pleasure to dig into it. So I will say that by way of an introduction. And again, it's a pleasure to be here and appear before the Anchorage Bar in right here. And I'm going to talk about Judge Noonan, who of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He died in April at age 90 and had a formidable obituary in the New York Times, for those of you who might want to look at it. I became acquainted with Judge Noonan's work through his 1984 book, Bribes, A History of Bribery from Biblical Times through the 1970s. The word tome is sometimes inaccurately used to describe any book larger than a pamphlet, but Bribes is a genuine tome. It's 829 pages. This is not a book made for airplane reading. I put it on my home scale. It weighs 4 pounds. I'm not sure of how I found out about this book. I don't remember. I confess my memory is impaired because I also didn't remember that I liked the book so much. I had Judge Noonan sign it here in Anchorage when he appeared here in August of 1988. He not only signed it, he noted the date. Bribes, I learned, is representative of Judge Noonan's approach, the lively voice in which he writes, his appreciation for good stories, and his thoroughness. Judge Noonan had to write well, or I would not have finished Bribes. The man was exhaustive without being exhausting. I wondered who becomes so interested in bribes that he studies it virtually from the beginning of history till his middle age. John Thomas Noonan was born in Boston in 1926. His father was a lawyer and no doubt provided some direction for his son's career. Boston in the 30s and 40s was known for its Irishness, its Catholicism, its corruption. Mayor James Michael Curley and his henchmen set a standard for corruption matched in few American cities. Maybe that's how John Noonan became interested in bribery. It was in the water of the Charles River. Noonan's education was one that produces a rising star, or more specifically, a rising Catholic star. He graduated from Harvard, studied at Cambridge, earned a doctorate in philosophy at Catholic University, where, among other things, he studied canon law, and obtained a law degree from Harvard. He practiced law with his father, then took a teaching position at Notre Dame before moving to the University of California at Berkeley. In 1985, President Reagan appointed him to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, where over a period of 30 years, he heard almost 3,500 appeals and wrote almost 1,100 opinions, according to his New York Times obituary. How did he have time for his voluminous production? He must have known the old admonition: start immediately and do the best you can. Let me give you a sample of Judge Noonan's prose and his approach from Bribes. The opening of the book immediately relaxes the reader who's holding that tome, because Noonan is so direct and conversational. His first sentence is, "This book is about bribes and those who take them, give them, or condemn them in a variety of cultures from ancient Egypt to modern America. The concept of the bribe at work is the book's theme and matter." 435 pages later, after a tour of bribery around the globe, we come to a section of a chapter on bribery in the United States with a one-word title, Yazoo, Y-A-Z-O-O. If you're ever wondering why our country's founders worried about humankind's baser instincts, here's a prime example. Judge Noonan sets up Yazoo this way. In the first decade of the new nation under the new constitution, the state of Georgia was offered a spectacular example of what could be done influencing a legislature, a crooked land deal that eventually became a matter before the Supreme Court. Georgia claimed some 35 million acres, mostly in what is now Alabama and Mississippi. Yazoo. Speculators through various companies were determined to convince the legislature to convey all 35 million acres to them. Investors included the federal district attorney for Georgia, a state judge, the only federal judge in Florida, several South Carolina congressmen, plus Yankees like Robert Morris and James Wilson, signers of the Constitution. Morris was a senator. Wilson was a member of the Supreme Court. He was dead before the court took up Yazoo. Wilson was in the Capitol when the campaign for legislative action began. How was the campaign conducted? Through bribery directed by a Revolutionary general, James Gunn. Noonan writes, Gunn's method was simple, to pay a legislator what he could do to get his vote. Lawmakers sold their votes for differing prices, some for $600, others for $1,000, and at least one other in quote-unquote Negroes, slaves. Frequently there were offers in shares, that is, acres of Yazoo. The bill passed, and Noonan says the legislature disposed of 35 million acres of the companies to the companies for $50,000, a price of 1.5 cents an acre. All but one lawmaker who voted for the sale was a shareholder in Yazoo. Georgia rage followed. All but two of the Yazoo men, as they were called, lost when they stood for re-election. The next legislature voided the bill and, to make their point, burnt it in public. We haven't had that around here, I don't think. Some of the Yazoo investors got their money back after the deal was canceled. Others, who Noonan dubs optimists, went to court. The story gets complicated, but Congress was convinced to compensate the remaining Yazoo claimants through what lawmakers came to call an amicable settlement, in which the investors received cash and the federal government obtained all of Yazoo, the acreage. Many of the investors were not original investors. Some of the shares had been inherited, others sold. Some shares were sold several times. There was considerable court activity until in 1810, when the U.S. Supreme Court, under John Marshall, took up the case, now known as Fletcher versus Peck, and made Fletcher versus Peck a milestone in American history by ruling that the state, Georgia, did not have the power to revoke the sale. You can read a lot about Fletcher versus Peck, most of it noting this was the first time the Supreme Court invalidated a state law, a precedent that had become recognized and, in fact, celebrated. In assessing the Yazoo land deal and the behavior of the Marshall Court, Noonan is writing as an historian and a moralist, not as an appeals court judge reviewing a case. An historian and moralist looks at everything known about the Yazoo deal. For Noonan, the primary precedent is not the one formally set by Marshall, the Supreme Court's ability to invalidate state law, but the highly placed, well-connected men, insiders, that they could manipulate the political system to manifestly corrupt ends. Near the conclusion of his commentary on Fletcher v. Peck, Noonan says, one can only observe that what cost the speculators a net $200,000 paid to Georgia in 1795, plus the bribes, was redeemed by a sum equal to one-third the amount that Napoleon paid for the entire Louisiana Purchase, $5 million. Judge Noonan is an observant moralist in bribes. In his 1979 book, A Private Choice, Abortion in America in the 70s, Noonan is an impassioned moralist. This is not history. It's a polemic in which Noonan, now at Berkeley, says Roe v. Wade was a quote-unquote act of raw judicial power. For those who don't remember, Roe versus Wade, 1973, was decided 7-2. The dissenters were Byron White and William Rehnquist. Harry Blackmun wrote for the majority, which included two of the most distinguished members in the history of the court, Thurgood Marshall and William Brennan. It's a bit absurd to reduce Noonan's argument to a few sentences, but I have to here. I don't have time. Noonan says, your rights flow from your human character. None of them have security if it rests with a group of nine men or a majority of them to define you out of the human race. No discrete and insular minority is safe if all its liberties can be removed by definition, by defining it as subhuman. That's what Noonan believes Blackmun did. he expunged the fetus from, quote, the legal order and left the fetus without protection, unquote. This is not a novel argument. Perhaps it was when Noonan wrote in the 70s. I mentioned that as a scholar, Noonan was acting as a judge of history in a broad sense. So here too, but I have no doubt that faced with Roe versus Wade as a historical matter and Roe versus Wade as a judicial matter, Noonan would reach the same conclusion. The last paragraph of the book reads, "There must be some limit to liberty so mistaken in its foundation, so far-reaching in its malevolent consequences, and so deadly in its exercise. There must be surpassing of such liberty by love." A really interesting couple of sentences. They tell you where Noonan stands, mostly. But what does he mean by surpassing of liberty by love? I find this mystifying, if not a form of religious mystification. It's what religious polemicists write in pamphlets, not judges in decisions. In the social order, what would love look like? Who would implement it, see that it thrives? From a secular perspective, Noonan is offering a sentiment, not a policy prescription. So Judge Noonan is conservative on abortion, but he is not a Federalist Society conservative or an Anton Scalia conservative, in that Noonan is not an original intent man. This upset one of the judges I know very much, that he wasn't an original intent man. Noonan says in the abortion book, "For the Constitution of the United States means not only what its words say or what the framers intended. It is a document like the scriptures of religion whose words are sacred but whose meanings change as it is reinterpreted in the light of changing circumstances. Its interpreters control its meaning." In a sense, Noonan is doubling down here. He talks about scripture that is reinterpreted. This would be an anathema to biblical literalists, just as his belief that the Constitution means more than what the framers said is informed by experience. I think Judge Noonan would agree with Judge Felix Frankfurter, who wrote almost seven decades ago, "There comes a point where the court should not be ignorant as judges of what we know as men. There comes a point where the court should not be ignorant as judges of what we know as men." This reminds me of a story about Justice Frank Murphy of Michigan, who was on the United States Supreme Court from 1940 to 1949. Judge Murphy had been mayor of Detroit, governor of Michigan, the Attorney General of the United States before he was appointed to the United States Supreme Court. He was involved in many major decisions during World War II, including Karamatsu, the Japanese internment camp, in which he was a vigorous dissenter. And it's clear to me that his dissent was in part a product of his deep Catholic faith. Judge Murphy was asked how he based his decision. He said, "I make my decisions on the basis of the Constitution and the meaning of America." What is that? Judge Murphy has allowed himself to define it as he sees fit. Judge Noonan fully understood precedent and knows why it is crucial to the law, but he was also hesitant. He knows precedents can be mistaken and overturned. That's what Roe versus Wade is for him, a wrong-headed, immoral precedent that must be overturned. Judge Noonan knows that judges are wrong. Supreme Court judges, too. For example, and this is my example, not Noonan's, no Supreme Court judge has been involved in rulings given bad reviews by history, that is future generations, than Melville Fuller, F-U-L-L-E-R, Melville as in Herman. Fuller, a Grover Cleveland appointee, was Chief Justice from 1888 to 1910. He was a Chicago commercial lawyer with roots in Maine, whose thinking probably was representative of his class, the people he mixed with, and his times. Some of the cases he gets bad reviews for. He spoke for the majority in Plessy versus Ferguson, which eventually became an embarrassment to the country and the court. In Pollock versus Ferguson, he found the income tax illegal. In U.S. versus E.C. Knight, he ruled for the Sugar Trust against the Sherman Antitrust Act. In Gonzales versus Williams, he ruled that Puerto Ricans were not citizens. They were non-citizen nationals. Having mentioned these decisions Fuller participated in, let me mention Judge Learned Hand's admonition, "The spirit of liberty is that spirit which is not too sure it's right." This was one of the fun things I found out in doing this work. Where did Learned Hand get that unusual name? And it made me wonder if, did he have a kid brother with the name Unlearned Hand? And they're names that always, when I was a kid, that mystified me. Early Wynn, who pitched for the Cleveland Indians. He was a pitcher. He was early. Did he win early? What was this all about? So you'll know. And I believe it's still true today. It was true at one time that Learned Hand was one of the most quoted lawyers or judges in the United States who was never on the Supreme Court. Learned Hand's real name is Billings Learned Hand. He was from Albany, New York. His father was a prominent appeals court lawyer. And Learned is his mother's maiden name and his middle name. So that's how he became Learned Hand. In reading Judge Noonan, I realized from his commentary on various cases before the Supreme Court that Noonan is probably close to a First Amendment absolutist when it comes to religious belief and, for that matter, religious behavior. He writes, "The religious right is beyond the power of the state because a human being cannot give up the relation and responsibility to God." This was from a 1998 Law Review article while he was judged, called "Religious Liberty at the Stake." Clearly, "at the stake" is metaphorical. He says so specifically. But he definitely considered the religious right, the right to religion, endangered, and in being endangered by the Rehnquist Court. In 1990, the Supreme Court took up Employment Division versus Smith, an Oregon case decided 5-4. Here, two members of the Native American Church who took peyote as a sacrament in a ceremony were fired for drug use, and they were denied unemployment compensation by the state of Oregon. Noonan thought the court, Scalia writing for the majority, got the decision completely wrong and violated the First Amendment Religious Freedom Clause. "The court's trajectory was downward," Noonan wrote, "away from Madisonian exemption of religion from government, and the native men," Noonan believed, "should have received unemployment checks." This was Noonan writing as a scholar. In EEOC versus Townley, a 1988 course before the Ninth Circuit, he wrote as a dissenting judge. Townley was a manufacturing company with a plant in Arizona. The Townleys were devout Christians who required all employees to attend Tuesday devotional services. The employees were paid and could sleep or read during the service. They could wear earplugs. A machinist named Lewis Pelvas, that's P-E-L-V-A-S, I may be mispronouncing it, but I don't know the pronunciation actually, was fired for failure to attend these religious events. Legal action against Townley followed. In the Arizona District Court, the judge found violations of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 by requiring employees to attend, by failing to accommodate the machinist's objections, by discharging the machinist. The court issued a summary judgment on the first two counts, an appeal followed, and the court, Judge Sneed, a Republican employee, finding for the EEOC. Judge Noonan disagreed. The government saw the machinists as coerced. Noonan wrote, "No such showing of coercion has been made. According to Pelvas, he was explicitly told that if he attended the prescribed meetings, he could wear earplugs and read a book or sleep. Wearing earplugs, he was not exposed to hearing a word of doctrine." All I can say to that is Judge Noonan's earplugs work a lot better than mine do. Noonan continued, "The First Amendment, guaranteeing the free exercise of religion to every person within the nation, is a guarantee that Townley Manufacturing Company rightly invokes. Nothing in the broad sweep of the amendments put corporations outside its scope." He further said, "The undisputed facts are that Jake and Helen Townley made an agreement with God that their company would be a faith-operated business, completely dedicated to God's service. From Noonan's perspective, the pair were freely exercising their religion, and the EEOC and the federal courts were violating the First Amendment and curbing the free exercise of religion by ruling against them. Much could be said here. Let me just say Judge Noonan's dissent reveals his deeply religious nature, the struggle devout people have with what is routinely, if loosely, called the world, and the widely different assumptions people, including judges, have about religion and society. To secularized people, a mandatory religious session at work, even with earplugs and reading matter, seems strange. Why would you do it? Think of this work requirement being imposed on you, or you imposing it on others. But I would bet that there are workplaces right here in town, private workplaces, where there are religious services at least once a week. And I'm going to guess that the employees go. They'd probably be small firms, that's for sure. For a lot of people, including judges, Noonan is in uncharted territory. Here's another example of uncharted territory, for many of us anyway. In the introduction to one of his books, Judge Noonan thanks John Dunn, D-U-N-N-E, John Dunn, for his assistance. Dunn was a priest and professor at Notre Dame. He was a member of the faculty when Noonan was there, and he died there. His memorial service was held at Notre Dame. I knew John Dunn through friends of mine back east. I spent a number of days with John Dunn over a period of years. When Dunn died a couple of years ago, one of his colleagues sent me a tribute he had written about him for reading at the Mass celebrating John's life. The colleague was also a Notre Dame priest. The colleague wrote near the end of his tribute, "He is now gone to become part of eternity." This is something most secular people don't think about, perhaps ever. What would becoming part of eternity actually be like? Trust me, Judge Noonan thought about questions like that. While I was reading this material about John Dunn and how he'd gone to join eternity, I came across an account of the death of the romantic poet Percy Bysshe Shelley. Shelley was drowned off the Italian coast in 1822. He was very young. It was very tragic. But Shelley had a reputation in England as someone who was certainly not a Christian. And one of the conservative English papers wrote the following on the death of Shelley: "The infidel poet Shelley has drowned. Now he knows whether there is a God or not." Pretty tough stuff, I'd say. Judge Noonan's books and his rulings may have sparked controversy and hostility in parts of America, but not in Catholic America. I have the impression that Catholic America, especially the Catholic universities, gave John Noonan every honor church institutions could bestow. In 1972, the Harvard University Press published Noonan's book, Power to Dissolve, Lawyers and Marriage in the Court of the Roman Curia. I had to look it up. The Curia is the administrative apparatus of the Holy See. This book is not tome-sized. It's only 489 pages. Despite my ignorance of the Catholic Church and the Curia, I found the book addictive. I could not stop reading. It's addictive because, once again, Noonan is such a clear, compelling writer and storyteller. Complicated matters of church doctrine are told through cases that appeared before the Curia, annulment cases. The cases are as much biographical studies, tales of individual lives and their intersection with other lives, as legal matters. Noonan is frank from the beginning. The Roman Catholic Church adamantly opposes divorce, and according to Noonan, is the only world religion with that view, or major world religion, I should say. But the church does allow annulments on many grounds, coercion being one, the failure of one of the members of the partners in the marriage to reveal the truth about his or her intents to the other. For example, a woman failing to tell a man she had no intention of having children, failing to consummate the marriage is another. Problems with how the marriage ceremony was conducted and where it was conducted. Noonan understands that obviously the state has the power to grant divorces, no matter what the view of the church, and he concedes that Protestants and non-believers can find the Catholic process of examining the marriage bond strange, if not absurd. In 1887, Frederick Parkhurst, a Maine man, a non-Catholic, married Marie Reed, a Catholic. They divorced in 1898, 11 years later. The marriage of a non-Catholic and a Catholic received special attention before church approval, and of course the divorce was not approved of by the church. This would have been the end of the marriage story, except Marie wanted to marry a prominent Italian Catholic in Italy. She needed an annulment. Priests came to Parkhurst's house, the former husband, from both Italy and the United States to ask him questions about his state of mind before the marriage. Who had said what before the marriage? Plans for raising the children before the marriage? Parkhurst viewed these questions as absurd. Why would anyone care about this? And eventually became very cranky. There's another reason he might have become cranky. He was a politician running for office and eventually became governor of Maine, briefly. Why do you keep asking me these about marriage? I consider over. This is of no interest to me. How's this helping me to answer your questions when you show up at my door, Father? My favorite chapter in this book involves the American heiress Anna Gould, the daughter of financier and robber baron Jay Gould. Miss Gould arrived in Paris in 1894 with $500,000 a year, at least, in her inheritance. In Paris, she was introduced to and schooled in European culture, and introduced and perhaps inadequately schooled in men. Miss Gould was not an exceptional beauty. Her wealth improved her complexion. The story of a young heiress having tea with gentlemen under the guidance of an older worldly chaperone, Fanny Reed, in fin de siècle Paris, is straight out of a Henry James novel. Not only is the story Jamesian, so is the Noonan's telling. Here's a sample. She was rich, and she had the reputation of being even richer, for her father had been the most celebrated of American financiers of his era. The intricacies and defense of American trusts were not within the ordinary education of European gentlemen. And on this spring day, Anna Gould enjoyed the homage of a European swarm. From this swarm emerged an aristocrat with a long name, a count, whose name ended in Castellane, C-A-S-T-E-L-L-A-N-E. But, wrote Judge Noonan, to put the case with commercial bluntness, the title was not the best money could buy. George Gould, Anna's brother, and who was looking out for her, could not have rated very highly the idle holder of a second-rate title, a man who Noonan says, quote, almost any American entrepreneur would have judged a dapper but common cheat, unquote. He was Catholic, she wasn't. The couple and their families overcame that in preparation for the marriage. The couples overcame his wasteful spending after the marriage, money she lavished on him. What the couple couldn't overcome was his affection for chorus girls and her unwillingness to tolerate his infidelity, although he was faithful enough to give her several children. They were married in 1895, and she divorced him in 1906. This is good. How did she get the goods on him in his infidelities? Today it might be some version of the butt call phone call in which the husband calls up his wife while he's engaged with his mistress. This has happened. In an easier time, when people were very rich, had servants, a servant delivered a note from a chorus girl announcing the time and date of an assignation, delivered it by mistake to the wife. They were married in 1895, and she divorced him in 1906, leaving Castellane penniless. The Goulds had set it up so he had no access to her money. He'd wasted money she'd given him. Anna didn't wait long to remarry. One of his cousins, also a count, who was indifferent to his church, or to the church he was raised in. Noonan writes, the husband had but one great talent, the art of marrying a rich woman, and bound as a Catholic for life, his single talent had to be buried. That is, unless he could get an annulment. The search for annulment lasted until 1925. Noonan takes the reader through the evidentiary gathering process, the hearings, the numerous rulings through a period of time more than four times longer than World War I. The count needed a ground for annulment. he chose the assertion that Anna Gould, typical of American young women, had told numerous people on the eve of the wedding, including his mother, that if the marriage didn't work out, she would obtain a divorce. This expression of bad faith would be grounds for annulment. The Curia judges were faced almost exclusively with a he said and she said. Anna and her friends insisted she had never spoken of divorce before the marriage. And then she had pure plausibility on her side. Would a young woman, even a very rich young woman, talk to her prospective mother-in-law about divorce on the eve of the wedding? And this was some wedding at a Manhattan mansion where composer Victor Herbert provided the music and celebrity chef Louis Sherry provided the food. Why did Anna bother with the church inquiry? As a practical matter, her life wasn't affected. My impression from reading Judge Noonan is she knew she wasn't going to concede. She wasn't going to concede to a charge she knew was false, and she was not going to let her wandering husband call her a liar without response. Where did Judge Noonan's Ninth Circuit cases fit in? Alaska cases, in particular. I've read a number of them, and what I see is a highly professional, non-ideological response to the kind of problems that migrate to the desk of an appeals court judge. Criminal cases, civil cases, business cases. If there's anything you probably would not see elsewhere, it is the cases that evolved out of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act and other Indian law cases that do not involve casinos. California produces, as you would expect, many casino cases. Noonan also wrote an opinion, this time for the majority, in another EEOC case. Somebody here might remember it, one which began during the Hickel administration and lasted more than a decade. This was a sexual harassment case filed by two women, Margaret Ward and Lydia Jones. The court found, with Noonan writing for the majority, that's the appeals court, that the Federal Government Employee Rights Act did not apply to a governor's policy-making assistance. I'm going to stop on these specifically Alaska cases. I'm thinking you, as Alaska lawyers, have either had personal experience with the Ninth Circuit or with Judge Noonan. And if you have further interest in his Alaska cases, they're easy to find. I do want you to know, if you don't, that the first appearance of the Ninth Circuit Court, circuit judges in the new state of Alaska was in Fairbanks. This was the case of the handsome bank robber, Dick Woodring, who robbed a bank in 1959. I've talked to you about him in the past. The unusual consequence of the year 1959 was that Woodring was indicted in a federal court and eventually tried in a state court. The Ninth Circuit came here in the summer, let me note, to hear Woodring's appeal of this procedure, of this improper procedure. The court ruled for Woodring. The solution was to have him tried and indicted and tried in a state court, and he was. In closing, I want to take a couple of minutes to discuss Noonan's 1976 book, Persons and Masks of the Law. Noonan reminds us that from the Old Testament onward, judges have been admonished not to take note of persons, who the individual is in front of them. He also says that those in the legal profession often don masks. For example, the court, as in, may I please address the court, is in Noonan's perspective a mask. And these masks are necessary, if not without troublesome consequences. In this book, Noonan addresses slavery in pre-revolutionary Virginia, in good measure through the biographical sketches of Thomas Jefferson and George Wythe. It's spelled W-Y-T-H-E, but I believe it is pronounced with. Eric, have I got it right? Okay, with. One of the things I learned about going to school in the South was there are a lot of names that aren't what you think they are. And there are two Beauforts, one in North Carolina and one in South Carolina. Some of you may know this. One of them's Beaufort, the other one's Beaufort, and they're within miles of each other. With was a lawyer, a signer of the Declaration of Independence, and a law teacher. Jefferson began studying law under him at age 17 in 1760. Later at William and Mary, Wythe became the first professor of law in the United States. Wythe drafted an oath to be taken by Virginia judges. They swore in Wythe's words to do equal right to all manner of people, great and small, high and low, rich and poor, according to equity and good conscience, and the laws and usages of Virginia, without respect of persons, unquote. Noble words, but how would they be applied to slavery? Noonan answered this question in a fashion that is unusual, if not unique, in historians' discussions of slavery. It's Noonan's judgment that slavery could not have existed as we knew it in Virginia without participation of lawyers. Black men and women were enslaved by more than brute force. They were enslaved by the law. Lawyers wrote the laws on the status of slaves. Lawyers wrote the laws on the codes that slaves lived by. Lawyers wrote the laws that provided for the punishment of slaves. In Wythe's Virginia, slaves could be either real property or personal property. Real property would be the slaves on a farm or a plantation. The important distinction is that farm slaves could be entailed, that is, willed, just like land. Personal property would be, for example, a slave in Richmond who was more or less a personal servant. Lawyers also provided that slavery was an inherited condition. If your mother was a slave, so were you. Noonan notes that the laws of property, status, and the laws of control conflicted. Property, an acre of ground, could not be ordered to shape up or else. Slaves were constantly admonished by their masters, with the assumption they understood the admonitions. Nobody expects a chair to understand anything. When in Paris, Thomas Jefferson took Sally Hemings shopping. The author of the Declaration spent 200 francs on her. He was spending money on her as a woman, not as a possession like that chair. Noonan writes, yet when he died, her ownership moved under the property clauses of his will, and her eventual fate had to depend on the claims of Jefferson's creditors, not consuming the estate. The mass he had accepted, constructed, sustained, distributed, permitted him to distribute Sally Hemings in a fashion that would have been impossible if the act of transmission he had to confront another living person. At the critical moments, the masks of the law covered the faces of the slaves. George Wythe's students followed the path he set. Wythe's students included Thomas Jefferson, James Monroe, Henry Clay, and John Marshall. Noonan says, deploring the evil, they overcame their objections to it and sustained the system, accepting the power of the law to convert persons into personality, that is, property. They could believe in the natural law of freedom and champion emancipation and enforce slavery so long as the legal universe was a special universe with its own rules. This is a devastating critique of slave law, and I never read anything like it until I read Judge Noonan. In the same book in which Judge Noonan wrote about Jefferson and Wythe, he also wrote about Oliver Wendell Holmes. Judge Noonan was not enamored with Holmes, one of the most influential law professors in American history, and even more influential as a member of the Supreme Court for close to 30 years. Noonan felt Holmes made the sovereign something approaching a deity, forcing Noonan to conclude, and not with approval, law for Holmes was not raw power, but force somehow subordinated to rule. Law for Holmes was not raw power, but force somehow subordinated to rule. Noonan believed the roots of Holmes' belief in the sovereign are found in his Civil War experience. Holmes was valiant in the Union cause, wounded several times. He came close to death. Combat led Holmes to believe that if the sovereign can put you in the line of fire where you may be killed, the sovereign can do damn near anything. The literary critic Edmund Wilson reached something of the same conclusion in his wonderful review of Civil War writers' patriotic gore. But Wilson went even further. Holmes was a Boston Brahmin, one of those born to rule Massachusetts, if not the nation. In fact, it was his father, Oliver Wendell Holmes Sr., who invented or coined the term Bust, and Brahman. And Edmund Wilson, the literary critic, concluded that Holmes, while he possessed many admirable traits, was a nearly insufferable snob. In fact, in a contest for America's greatest snob, he'd be near the top. Let me give you an example. Wilson said that Holmes, when mentioning novelist Henry James, always noted he was of Irish ancestry, presumably inferior to the Anglo-Saxon, described Henry's brother William, the philosopher, as lively but not taken seriously as a thinker, and said of Lincoln that while he made eloquent speeches, Abraham Lincoln was not top drawer. Think of this. Holmes was looking down on Henry James, William James, and Abraham Lincoln. How tall does Mount Olympus have to be before you get this perspective? Kevin Starr, a California historian who wrote a number of wonderful books about the Golden State, knew Judge Noonan well. Like the judge, Kevin Starr died earlier this year. And I commend Kevin Starr's books on California to any of you who are looking, maybe you're from California, want to know more about your state. A wonderful writer. Before closing, I would like to read you a paragraph Starr wrote in tribute to his friend. Philosopher, theologian, historian, and poet, Noonan has been first and foremost a scholar of the law. The law, so seemingly complete in itself as a system and thought and expression, is an essential branch of general literature. A science, however inexact, the law is a humanistic pursuit as well. And no one in the last four decades has pursued the law with such humanistic fervor, a humanism enlightened by religion, as John Noonan. This was Kevin Starr. For myself, I will just say thank you, John Thomas Noonan. Thank you for your scholarship, your many contributions to the judiciary. Thank you for your service to your church and your service to your country. And thank you. I want to tell a little anecdotal story that's not Judge Noonan, but this whole question of original intent. I went to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals hearings last week. I don't think I saw any of you there because you probably didn't have cases, but Judge Mylon Smith was a member of the three-judge panel. Tell you a little bit about him. He was born in 1942, so he's a little older than I am. He's the brother of Gordon Smith, who was a U.S. Senator from Oregon for one or two terms. Somebody here will know the answer to that. He's a graduate of BYU Law. He was a very lively inquisitor on the bench, and he really got my attention in a case involving Petrostar and British Petroleum. This was a contract case in which Petrostar and BP were arguing over a tariff rebate. Petrostar argued that there was some ambiguity in the contract between the two parties and that BP bore the burden on the controversy as the author of the contract. BP argued that Petrostar was an equal partner in authorship of the contract. This was really something because Judge Smith wasn't having any of this and he just went after this BP lawyer. He said, I spent 37 years writing oil and gas contracts, and are you telling me? I mean, this was an immediate appeal to his personal experience. It was only later that they got into, as they would say, some law that is the precedent-setting case. In other words, Smith, the first thing he did was appeal to his experience, not the law, although he soon enough got to president. Three things stood out, and these are moments you don't want to have if you're British Petroleum lawyer. And he was very good. He was a New York lawyer. The lawyer for Petrostar was very good, too. He was from Bethesda, Maryland, and had been a clerk to several Supreme Court justices. Judge Smith says to the BP lawyer, you're an officer of the court? Yes. Officer of the court is expected to tell the truth? Yes. Well, get on with it. or something like that. Trying to establish this matter of the two parties being equal in negotiating this contract. This is where Smith again was saying, I negotiated contracts for 37 years. I know all about negotiating contracts. Don't tell me this. Then he went on to say, Petrostar was to BP as a wart is to an elephant. Also, when it moved along a little further, Judge Smith, who had this fantastic hair. You've seen people with really thick hair that comes down here. He had Jerry Lee Lewis hair, just wonderful hair. he told the BP lawyer, if you believe that, then I want to know what you had for breakfast. This is when you know your case is not going very well. Now, Judge Graber, who was the presiding judge, said, well, this is, you're fighting over this tariff rebate. It's really a windfall. Wouldn't it be best if you went back to your parties and settled this? And the other judges made it clear they didn't want to be involved in apportioning who was going to get some, or sending it back to Judge Burgess, having him decide who was going to get so much money, and then having it appealed again. They wanted to get this over with. So the attorney, Eric Citron, for Petrostar said, oh yeah, he'd go back and talk to his people and they would be willing to work on a settlement. And the New York City lawyer for BP said, but you'd expect him to say, I cannot speak for BP, to which the judges say, well, you better find out who does, or something like that. It was a very unusual moment, and this is probably as close as I'm ever going to get to hearing a federal judge say to a lawyer in front of an appeals court, don't bullshit me. Okay, that's what I have to offer you today. Thank you. And we have at least one person here who worked for Judge Noonan. Madam, please tell us briefly about your experience with Judge Noonan. She typed part of the manuscript I quoted from.
So it was a really interesting manuscript, and it was interesting working for him. He was a very kind man. His writing is rather bold, but in person, he was like painfully shy. I mean, just was the kind of person who wouldn't even look you in the eye when he was talking. Very nice.
I don't know how many times he was up here as a judge. I know he was up here at least once. Okay, I'll be glad to stick around for a couple minutes afterwards if anybody's got any questions. Thank you. It's 1 o'clock, so I see many people are going to have to get back to work.